The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
From Tongmei Zangpo's 37 verses on the practice of a bodhisattva, verse 14. Even if someone broadcasts all kinds of unpleasant remarks about you throughout a billion worlds, with a heart full of love to proclaim their good qualities in return is the practice of a bodhisattva. So this morning we're concluding an introductory retreat weekend. So some of you who are joining us from home or been with us for the weekend, delving into different aspects of Buddhist practice and teachings as we take it up here. Others of you are just joining us for the morning. And we're also sitting in the midst of our days leading up to the election, which is sitting within each of us in our own ways and in its own way. And so in the the teachings and practice is always presenting us with and inviting us to actually live in this real world. We would like to live in a different world. We might think, and with validity, that the world we want to live in does not exist yet. We've not seen it yet. And that can be our fantasy, it can be our aspiration. But this is the world we're living in. It is the world of our creation, in more ways than we know. And that is also the good news and the bad news. Because we cannot appeal to anyone else, to any outside force, it's up to us. And that's the good news and the bad news. Are we up to that? What do we really want in this human life, in this human world? And how far does that reach? How far does that extend? Does it extend beyond the tip of our nose in terms of the extent of our concern? Does it extend to those people that who live in our house or share our name? Does it extend to those people who look like us? How far does it reach? Evidently not far enough. Not yet. Not for enough of us. And so these teachings, because that has always been true, these teachings have been given to us. Not only as medicine, but as clarion calls to respond to the world of our creation, to meet it, to understand it, to take the responsibility each of us needs to, and to aspire to creating, as we discover the true world that exists within us, to then be able to create that world between us. Khyentse Rinpoche, in commenting on this verse, said, so this is a series of verses by Tongmei Zangpo, who is a master going back into, I think, the 14th, 15th century. 37 verses on the practice of a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is a great being, an enlightening being, enlightening oneself and others, for whom that great concern reaches beyond any boundary. There is no limit to it. They do not exclude anyone from their heart. Kensei Rinpoche said, in all circumstances, it's important to act in accordance with the Dharma, especially at difficult moments. And we might think of those moments as the ones in which we experience some threat, not just to our body, which exists, and for some more than others, but also to our sense of self. And that happens for everyone all the time. What is the point of having received these teachings if we don't make use of them? Unfavorable circumstances are the best opportunity you will have to put the teachings into practice. And this is an understanding that isn't just based in Buddhism, that in so many areas of study, of endeavor, of development, those in those areas know that some of the most important learning they will gain is in situations that are difficult. If you want to learn how to sail a boat, you can't just go out when it's sunny and you have a favorable wind. I remember even just being a musician and practicing or performing in different situations. The stage is not good, the lighting's no good, it's too cold, it's too hot. And how do you practice in accord with the teachings, the Dharma, especially when it's difficult? Why does he say that? Because the tendency when it's difficult is to revert back to what we know. And when that which we know, when the strongest part of that is our habitual, conditioned, ongoing samsaric thoughts and actions and words, then that's what we trust and go back to. But in training, what happens is that balance, if you will, starts to tip. Where what we begin to revert back to, the training we revert back to, is our Dharma training. Not just our old habits. I remember, I was thinking about this when I was spent many, many years working in restaurants. And I realized that when it was really busy and the pressure was on, that was usually when whether I was a waiter or whether I was a cook, that was usually when I was at my best. And when things got very slow, I got sloppy. People would come in, it was like, oh, I have to get up and serve you, or I have to get up and make some food. Right? And it was sloppy. And I noticed that and wondered about that. But why is this so? Why is this a truth that is particularly understood in Buddhism? And it's not that suffering is in some way noble. That's not it. That's not the point. Suffering is hard. It's painful. Sometimes it's dangerous. But there's something that happens in our mind when we encounter adversity. Given that we so universally desire encouraging, pleasant experiences and want to avoid painful ones, why is encountering especially difficult moments such important opportunities, the best opportunities, Kensei Rinpoche says, to develop ourselves, to free ourselves? Well, think about it. When something happens, when somebody says something kind, praises you, how does that make you feel? We feel supported, affirmed, seen, valued. We love that feeling. It feels good. We feel uplifted by their words. We sort of ride on that cloud. We like that person. We want to be next to them, close to them, want to keep them close, want to be good to them, reward them so that they keep offering that. When something else happens, somebody says something critical, mean-spirited, how does that make us feel? Angry, annoyed, resentful, not seen? We don't like that feeling. It drags us down. We don't like that person in this moment. We want them to go away. We want them to shut up. We might want to hurt them, punish them. We might bring back our own critical words. Even if someone broadcasts all kinds of unpleasant remarks about you throughout a billion worlds. Thubten Chodron says, in commenting on this, says, what does the Tongme Zangpo recommend that we do in such a situation? Take out a full-page ad in the New York Times and explain our side of the story? No. Criticize the other person in return so that we shatter their reputation? No. Curl up in a ball and feel sorry for ourselves because no one understands or supports us? No. He tells us to return, in return, to speak of this person's good qualities with a loving mind and to do that genuinely. Not as a formula. It means we have to dig deep, find those qualities and bring them out. She says, this sounds impossible. And we may wonder if Tongme Zangpo is crazy. We think, speak of this person's good qualities? They have no good qualities. Anybody who criticizes me is bereft of good qualities. Isn't this the criteria we use to evaluate people? Somebody who likes me is a good person. Somebody who doesn't is a bad person. Is this really a good way to evaluate, to see, to understand people? Is this a good way to determine who we relate to? She says, we're so easily manipulated. Somebody comes along and with a manipulative motivation flatters us. We sit there and bask in it, wanting more praise. We think anyone who says something nice about us is a wonderful person. She says, we have no discriminating wisdom. We have no discriminating wisdom. This verse is characterized in different ways, returning praise for slander, relinquishing attachment to our reputation, speaking well, even of those you dislike. We think of our reputation, the sense of our reputation, as the beliefs and opinions that other people hold about us. So people have ideas in their mind. They see us in a certain way. They imagine us. When they look at us, certain things come to mind. And when those are positive, which usually means they affirm our sense of self, that's what makes us feel good, that our sense of self is sort of massaged in a sense. And when that isn't happening, we react defensively, angrily. We have no discriminating wisdom. Discriminating wisdom is the mind that sees through not only our own projections and false conceptions, but others. So that we don't give rise to and get entangled in our karmic formations, which is essentially the whole congregation of our past words and ideas and experience and gestures and everything that has been continually telling us who we are, what we are. And in that, we are also simultaneously being told who we're not and what we're not. To cultivate discriminating wisdom, the mind that sees clearly, that isn't deceived. We have this within us. That's what the Buddha realized. Each of us has the enlightened mind. It just needs to be brought forth. And that's what these teachings are pointing to. Use all situations to do that. The ability to see without grasping at our likes and dislikes, without hearing and seeing and thinking in terms, exclusively in terms of what is me, what is mine. I was thinking of a talk by Brené Brown where she talks about our penchant, our tendency to get caught in this negative thinking. And she said, you know, it's like when you get called in by your boss or a teacher or somebody, and they go through a whole list of all of the good things you're doing, all of the good qualities, And at the very end said, and there's one thing that maybe you could work on. And so there's one comment that's sort of a critical, helpful comment. And we walk out and we forget every good thing that they said. And all we think about is that one thing. It made me think of times when Dada Roshi would call me into the Dokusan room or call me up and say, you know, somebody's remarked on a talk that you gave recently and said such and such. Then he would say, is that what you said? And I would like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. And he was doing exactly what I needed and what he needed to do, which was to continue to be my teacher and to continue to help me see myself. But what I heard was that's what I was. Everything got reduced to that one criticism. Or he was pointing out something that I said that was not quite right. Right. And so, of course, if I thought about it, would I want him to ignore that and for me to go on and just have erroneous views? Of course not. But that's not what was coming forth in that moment. Or when I would go into Dokusan and present a koan, and he would say, no, that doesn't reach it. And, you know, lots of times that was okay, and I went back to my cushion, but sometimes it was not okay, and I was like, oh, God, I'm such an idiot. I will never understand this Dharma. And that's why I hated going into Dokusan right before I had to give a talk. Because if that was what happened, I would walk out thinking, I have no right giving a talk. Who am I kidding? How am I going to face these people? I don't know anything. Didn't he just say that? Didn't he just tell me that I don't know anything, that I haven't accomplished anything? And of course that's not what he said. But that's what I heard. Does this mean that we should just be indifferent or deaf to the words of others? No, that's just another extreme. It's very rare, I mean, although we do see examples of this in high places, it's very rare that somebody says something that is utterly false about us. There's almost always truth in it. And if we want to understand ourselves, if we want to see what is true, if we want to uncover those things that are not clear to us, then should we want to listen and to pull out that which is true? But if we're reactive and defensive and angry, then it's going to be very hard to do that. So to take advantage of what others may think or say about us, which means we then all should take advantage of the resentment or the resistance or the irritation or the judging mind that arises when we hear such words. The Dalai Lama said it's the general practice of the world to be happy, to be pleased when one is praised, and to be displeased or unhappy when one is insulted. However, because there's a danger when one is insulted of being discouraged, it's a practice of bodhisattvas to make use of this situation in a positive way. It's kind of interesting that he frames it that way. The danger is that we could be discouraged. Right? In other words, that we lose sight of things, we lose our way, that something in that moment becomes more important. We place something in front of us that becomes more important than our own freedom, than breaking free. We don't actually see this as the place, this is the place I am not free. Right? You just helped me see that by saying something that I heard, or that was, in fact, painful or discouraging. So in that sense, from a bodhisattva's perspective, you are helping me to do that. You are helping me to see that. So how do we practice this? By listening carefully and practicing that. And when we see the walls building up within us as we're listening, we realize, oh, oh, oh. You let the walls fall down. In other words, you turn towards your hearing. You turn towards your eyes and you look and you hear and you just what is actually happening. Which means we have to, at the same time, be aware of what is rising up within us, which would block that out. You know, I think of when we sit Zazen and we sit with the eyes slightly open, that we're learning how to look inwardly and outwardly at the same moment and not put them against each other. We're learning how to let the world flow through our senses and not get stuck on them. Isn't that what we need in such a moment? But we have to recognize that we're getting stuck. We have to recognize those walls rising and the heart shrinking and the defenses forming, the argument coming into place. It is one of the excellent, excellent aspects of koan training, is you get rejected 100,000 billion times. You want to see this teaching, you want to realize this Dharma, and you present it to your teacher over and over, and no, that's not it. Go back to your seat. That's not it. Go back to your seat. That's not it. Go back to your seat. I remember Chosen Roshi years ago saying that, because she was still practicing her as a doctor, as a pediatrician, and she was working a lot with young people who had been abused, and so she would sometimes testify in court on behalf of the child and sort of as a medical expert. And she said her koan training with Mizumi Roshi prepared her so well for the ways in which the attorney would try and take her apart and dismantle any credibility that she had and get her riled up or agitated or nervous. And she said she realized how valuable that koan training was to just stay on that seat, face that tiger, and know her mind. But the bodhisattva doesn't stop here. To make use of this situation in a positive way means for both ourselves and others, with a heart full of love, proclaim the good qualities of this person. And as Stubden Chodron says, this sounds impossible. These teachers must be crazy. They must have lived in a time when, you know, that was not really that serious, right? When that wasn't really happening in a difficult, in a truly difficult way, right? They were just monks living in their little cloistered monasteries, you know, easy, easy, easy. Rather than thinking that these teachings are crazy, we should realize samsara is what's crazy. Repeating the cause of our suffering over and over and over, that's what's crazy. Not recognizing the source of our suffering is what's crazy. To do what others do because that's what they have done, and to do that over and over without examining, without inquiring, without reflecting on cause and effect, that's crazy. An early meaning of crazy means broken, impaired, full of cracks and flaws. That's a pretty good definition of samsara. And it's interesting how this works out in training, right? These moments of criticism, of slander, as we hear it. There's a koan where a student comes to Master Zhaozhou, who is very fond of the Faith Mind poem, and said, "The great way has no difficulties, just avoid picking and choosing," the first line of that poem. "What is not picking and choosing?" the student asked Master Zhaozhou. Zhaozhou says, "In heavens and on earth, I alone am the honored one." And the student says, "This is still picking and choosing." And Zhaozhou says, "Stupid oaf, where's the picking and choosing?" There's another time where Master Linji teaching the Sangha said, there's a true person with no rank always going in and out through the doors of your face, of your senses. A student stood up and says, what is the true person of no rank? And Linji got down from his seat and grabbed the student. And the student hesitated. And Linji pushed him away and said, the true person of no rank, what a dry piece of shit he is. Both of these koans present a clear, unobstructed opening. They're speaking a truth for the benefit of these students. These teachers are loving these students all over. But why does every student working on these koans get their shirt caught on the nail of stupid oaf, dry piece of shit? What are you calling me? That's what we hear. That's why those koans are so powerful. They use the language of samsara to test us. And not to just rise above it. I'll tell you why I'm not a stupid oaf. But to realize this is no threat. And then to realize, oh, this is not criticism. You are waking up my mind. You are startling me out of my craziness. And you use a little bit of crazy to do it. The doubtful, fearful, affirming-seeking mind hears criticism and ridicule and condemnation, and it makes sense, right? Who wouldn't? That's why it's so powerful. It's called seeing a cage. You build a cage. This is to make use of the situation in a positive way. If we look at this teaching of Tsongpo's from the point of view of compassion, which is his whole point, and reverence for life, if someone broadcasts all kinds of unpleasant remarks about you, hurtful remarks, disparaging remarks, and that arises from their ignorance, from their fear, their hatred, their not seeing you, when that's based in their perception of the absolute nature of race, what we call race or gender or sexual orientation or faith or class, and that is being used to diminish or disregard or injure or hurt or kill you, and those have been solidified into ages, generations of oppression, of views and actions and systems, and that is causing you the loss of rights or freedom or safety or opportunities or life, at that moment, should that person hearing, being on the receiving end of such unpleasant remarks, respond with a heart full of love and proclaim the good qualities of their oppressor in return? I think much about this. Are there situations and times or ages in which these teachings do not apply? Is the Dharma, after all, true in some settings and not true in others? True for some people and not true for others? If it is, then we are in serious trouble, people. Serious trouble. As a person speaking from a place of whiteness, of maleness, of being cisgendered, of being able-bodied, of not having asked for but being a member of these dominant groups within our society, I cannot speak from the experience of a person or from identities that are targeted by those dominant groups that have experience, do experience on a daily basis, the sharp point of those words, of that knife, of those guns, of those laws, of those systems. But I have deep faith and believe in these things. That practicing these teachings are intended to and will challenge each of us more than any other human endeavor we will take up. And to make use of these teachings, to take them in our own spiritual practice seriously, is a fundamentally spiritual matter, regardless of what or where or when a situation appears or who we are in it. It will make a difference in terms of how we hear it. It will make a difference in terms of how near or far that teaching may appear to us in that moment, how sane or crazy it might seem. Because of Buddha nature, we each possess the basic freedom of wisdom and compassion. That was the Buddha's enlightenment. Already home. Already free. Already equal. Because of our own karma and the unequal, profoundly unequal worlds we were born into, we will be challenged differently. We live in different worlds. I remember years ago, I was in the city, and there's a student from, a black man from Greenhaven, our first prison saga. And I cite his race because it's relevant to the story. And I picked him up and brought him because he wanted to spend a few days at the monastery. And on the way up, we were talking. And he lived in the Bronx, and he was just talking about what his life was like on a daily basis. And he was telling the story because there was a lot in the news, and this is some years ago, about black men being killed, unarmed black men being killed by police. And he was saying, that's been going on his whole life, he said. And he started telling me a story that was just such a story and was... I don't remember the details of it, but I remember it was kind of on the level of the murder of George Floyd. And I said to him, I never heard about that. I didn't know about that. And he looked at me and he said, no, you wouldn't. You wouldn't know about this. He said, you live in a different world, Shugan. And he didn't say it with malice. He didn't say it with hatred. He just said it as fact because it's true. Of course you wouldn't have heard of it. Whatever our situation, our own state, because all things appear as a result of causes and conditions, and it's so important that as practitioners we go into what that means. So it's not just words, it doesn't sound some sort of like technical Buddhist speak, right? Some abstraction, right? Doesn't touch our hearts, so it's like, okay, I'm not going to really pay attention to that, it sounds too complicated or just sort of dry. It's critical to understand what this means. We, in a sense, we cannot practice unless we understand what this means. Because everything appears as a result of causes and conditions in a ceaseless state of appearing and disappearing. Nothing is fixed. There is no inherent anything. When it comes to liberating our minds, what that means is nothing is determined. Nothing is set. The gate is always open. The gate is always gateless. What it means is do not give up on yourself. Do not give up on others. The only place from which that makes sense is when we believe that things are set, unmovable. And if we are not able or ready to take up these teachings in the very profound ways that they are being presented to us, and take them up in any way you can. Which is really just saying, in a sense, what we will do if we are going to practice. We could hear them and just saying, okay, hear these teachings and say, okay, I can't do that, so I guess I can't do anything. It's like sitting down to do Zazen and saying, well, I can't just enter into a deep state of samadhi, so I guess I'm not cut out for this. Practitioners don't think that way most of the time, or don't think of that way enough of the time to actually get enough practice so that they can see the fallacy of that way of thinking. So it's really the same thing. I realize, you know, thank you, Master Zangpo, I'm really not ready to engage it at that level. Okay. Very well. At what level are you ready to engage it? Find a level. It exists. And that a level means find a moment. Find those moments that are happening already. And enter there. That is perfectly good. That's not like second string practice, you know. It's what it is. It's practice. And because nothing is set and determined, you are moving. When you engage at the level that you are and you can, and you do that genuinely, you are in motion on the path. And you cannot predict, and I speak from my own experience, you cannot predict, you cannot know what is possible within you. You might think, yeah, I would like to be a little bit more compassionate, but you know, what these people are talking about? I just can't even conceive. That's okay. You don't have to conceive it. It's not about having an idea and then trying to put that on like a suit. So I want to quote again from Dr. Martin Luther King's speech that he gave in Montgomery, Alabama, in 1957. He quoted St. Matthew. You've heard it's been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. You've heard people saying this. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them that despitefully use you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. Are these words familiar? And then Dr. King goes on to say, certainly these are great words, words lifted to cosmic proportions, boundless, vast. And over the centuries, many persons have argued that this is an extremely difficult command. Many would go so far as to say, it just isn't possible to move out into the actual practice of this glorious command. It's crazy. They would go on to say that this is just additional proof that Jesus was an impractical idealist who never quite came down to earth. So the arguments abound. Oh, do they ever? And the thing about arguments, they're so easy. They're cheap. Everybody has one, right? Actually, everybody has many. And they're so useful. And you can have argument parties. And you can have argument parties with people you hate, or you can have argument parties with people you love. And you can all have the same argument. And we do this. It's what Wendell Berry calls the ain't it awful conversation. We all sit around, ain't it awful? Yeah, it's awful. Oh, it's so awful. Oh my God, yeah, it's awful. We all agree it's so awful. And I fall into this. And it feels good on a certain level. And it solidifies us. It paralyzes, it blinds us. So Dr. King says, but far from being an impractical idealist, Jesus has become the practical realist. The words of this text glitter in our eyes with a new urgency, and so too now. Far from being the pious injunction of a utopian dreamer, remember what his life was like. Jesus, Dr. King. This command is an absolute necessity for the survival of our civilization. Yes, it is love that will save our world and our civilization. Love even for our enemies. And then he goes on to say, now let me hasten to say that Jesus was very serious when he gave this command. He wasn't playing. He realized that it's hard to love your enemies. Of course he knew this. Of course Togme Zanpo knows this. He realized that it's difficult to love those persons who seek to defeat you, those persons who say evil things about you. He realized it was painfully hard, pressingly hard, at times impossibly hard. What are you asking of me? But he wasn't playing. And we cannot dismiss this passage as just another example of hyperbole, just a sort of exaggeration to get over the point. This is a basic philosophy of all that we hear coming from the lips of our Lord. Because Jesus wasn't playing, because he was serious. So we have the Christian and moral responsibility to seek to discover the meaning of these words and to discover how we can live out this command and why we should live out this command. Very important. So we have the responsibility. Of course, he was speaking as a Christian in a church to Christians. A Christian and moral responsibility. Are they different? I can't imagine that he would say yes. They are one and the same. We have a Buddhist and moral responsibility. Are they different? They cannot be different. But can't we go on and say we have the human and moral responsibility and they are not different? To seek to discover the meaning of these words. What are you saying? What is the Bodhisattva path? What are these teachings actually saying to me? How can I live this out? And why should I live this out? Very important. To do that examination, why should I live this way? Why shouldn't I just respond in kind? Why shouldn't I just get angry? You know, I was remembering one of our senior students who was walking, told me the story. She was in a gay pride march many, many years ago, either in New York or Washington. It was a big march. So she was, you know, huge crowds walking down Fifth Avenue, wherever they were. And they got stuck at a certain point where they just had to stop for whatever reason. And so they're standing there. She's standing with a group of people. And there's an anti, a sort of a protest group over on the side who is just like yelling vitriolic, hateful words. And so they're stuck there while they're getting sort of vomited over by these words. She can't move. And she said, she's something like, I don't know what happened. I don't know what came over me, but she just walked over there. And she started doing prostrations. That's a good practice. We should just be doing prostrations to ourselves, to each other, to our enemies, blue and red, right and wrong, to our earth. Just doing prostrations and examining what is the meaning of that? How can I practice that which is this bow? And why should I? A good way to start is, well, when I don't do that, how does that work out? We usually get answers coming in pretty quickly. The Buddha in the Dhammapada said, there is only one eternal law, Hate never vanquishes hate. Only love vanquishes hate. It's a law. It's a truth. Wars do not end wars. They prepare the next one. Hatred does not bring about love. It brings about hatred. This is a karmic law. The Buddha said, let us live with happiness, hating none, though others hate. Let us live without hate among those who do hate. A very great command, a very challenging teaching. Nobody said this was going to be easy. Right? We didn't know how difficult it was going to be. You know, when we first hear those teachings or those words about how difficult it's like, I remember I framed it's like, yeah, I know, I've done difficult things, so I sort of put what you're saying in this difficult box. I've done that before. I'm up for that level of difficulty. Having no idea what I'm talking about, but feeling very confident. And then finding out, oh, I had no idea what you were saying. I had no idea. Not really. How big, how vast, how courageous, how true you were suggesting I am. And I have the capacity to live my life as. An old master said, may attachment and aggression which arise from constant focus on the self and lead to perceiving everything as a threat come to me, dissolve into me, taking and giving. I take it on. I invite it in, into my mind, into my body. I receive it. I receive the hatred. I receive the fear. Come to me, dissolve into me. My mind is that large. My heart is that open. I give to all beings under the sky all my merit born of the four boundless thoughts. May your minds be filled with kindness and compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity. And so I bring forth these teachings of these great masters today, at this particular moment in time, when we are being asked, as Khyentse Rinpoche said, if we are going to be on this path, then we should practice this path. And practicing the path, this path, means these things. And so I really implore all of us to do that over these next days and weeks. And to keep coming together. We're going to continue having our meetings in the evenings. And we'll see what happens over the next few days, and we'll keep responding to that. And turning together towards each other, and as need be, turning outward as need be. But to remember, when it gets especially hard, that is why we train and practice. Desmond Tutu, who was so deeply involved in the truth and reconciliation process when apartheid fell in South Africa, and who wrote so much about it, said, we may be surprised at the people we find in heaven. God has a soft spot for sinners. His standards are quite low. You'd be surprised who he lets in.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.